Thank you. I would just simply ask the marshal to call us to order, and then I'll announce the case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Chief Judge Siegel, and Judge Riley, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Our one and only Zoom argument today is A23-1675, the will and the appointment of the estate of William C. Mackey, deceased. As all parties are aware, this is a Zoom hearing. This matter is being recorded. However, our rules prohibit private recordings. So if anyone is simply watching this on the internet, I would ask you not to record, as that violates our rules. This will be available in audio streaming later today or tomorrow. As all parties are aware, the multiple appellants will be splitting their time. First, we will hear for Mr. Kemp, who is counsel for Catherine Arndt, and then second, who will have 7 minutes. He will be followed by Mr. Haggerud, who is counsel for First Fiduciary Corporation, and then finally, the respondent will have 15 minutes for rebuttal, and then finally, for their argument, and then finally, there'll be a 5-minute rebuttal for Mr. Kemp. So with that, I would ask Mr. Kemp if you could please start and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Kemp. I appear with Paul Funke on behalf of interested parties Tom Mackey and Kathy Arndt. May it please the court. Your Honor, the court below erred to dismiss the petition of First Fiduciary Corporation, which was joined by the interested parties, to hear and determine the liability of respondent for actions that occurred prior to her removal, but not discharge, by the court in 2014. This is an error as a matter of law that this court reviews de novo and should reverse. I'm going to focus for my part of the argument on the question of whether 541.05 governs as a bar under the statute for the proceeding brought by First Fiduciary Corporation. But before doing that, it's important to lend context to what the personal representative has done in this case and why this liability arises. The liability of a personal representative is different in some ways than the standard presentation of a breach of fiduciary duty. Because in this case, a personal representative voluntarily assumes fiduciary duties in an action often commenced by the personal representative herself. The personal representative is appointed by the court in a case like this, and all the actions taken are intrinsically entwined in the action already opened, again, often by the personal representative herself. The personal representative assumes a duty in the litigation, and that duty that she assumes is one that she knows will be reviewed in that litigation. As a
Mr.
personal
Kemp, can you tell us the difference between being removed and being discharged?
Yes, Your Honor. The removal of a personal representative by a court removes his or her ability to act on behalf of the estate. A discharge from the personal by the personal representative discharges the liability he or she may have for the actions taken. These two things can, but don't need to, be done at the same time. And that's important. You look like you're going to follow up, Your Honor.
Was both the original PR, was the successor PR discharged, or was that person also removed?
The person was removed, Your Honor, and their liability has been discharged by operation of settlement in this case.
And I just want to be clear, there was no, by the first person representative, pursuant to 524.3-1005, she never prepared a closing statement. Is that a fair statement?
Correct. There was an interim accounting and a final accounting that was filed on April 24th, 2014, but no statement to close has been filed at all in this case. And that's important.
And how would a final accounting differ from a closing statement?
The final accounting in this case, Your Honor, simply accounted for the transactions undertaken by the personal representative through the date of that final accounting. In a case like this, what you would normally see is that the court has a final accounting at the end of the case when all of the assets are ready to be distributed. In this case, that hasn't happened yet, in part because the liability of the first personal representative for her actions hasn't quite been established yet. And that's something that would be part of this.
I'm going to ask all attorneys this question. And do you think this case should be made precedential? And if so, what would the syllabus point be if you think it should be?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it necessarily has to be. And the reason for that is in this case, we are arguing interpretation of statute that might be helpful, but it's not going to be helpful in a wide array of cases. There's a particular presentation here where we've got a third personal representative looking back to the first personal representative for a case initiated in 2003. I won't say this is the longest running. This may be actually the longest running case. There's been a couple of others that I've had that have been this long, but most cases resolve fairly quickly. So the question about the liability of the personal representative and a breach of fiduciary duty for a personal representative in a probate context comes down to actions that she's taken solely within the confines of the action already initiated in 2003. And so 54105 doesn't squarely address proceedings within that action. 54105 is best read in a statute of limitations claim for breach of fiduciary duty to bar a new action. The court probably more commonly sees breach of fiduciary claims, for instance, between business partners. But in this case, the personal representative respondent already had notice, and in fact, voluntarily assumed the fiduciary duty, had notice in 2014 that not only did she have a fiduciary duty, but the court had found cause to believe that she had violated that fiduciary duty. And under 524.3-1001, the personal representative could always have petitioned for discharge. In other words, the question raised earlier, what about a discharge? The respondent in this case, during the 8 years between the point she was removed and the filing of the petition by a first fiduciary, could always have petitioned the court. So the purpose of the statute of limitations here to give notice and give repose after the running of that
statute. If that first PR had moved to be discharged under 524.3-1001, would that have still not removed the statute of limitations issues unless she had filed a closing statement?
No,
go ahead. Or could she just say, I'm out of here, discharge me, and that starts the clock running, even whether she did a closing statement or not?
That would extinguish her liability in that the court at that point would determine any liability, and that would be a bar by adjudication. Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. I'll turn it over to my co-counsel for the position of first fiduciary.
Thank you, Mr. Kemp. We'll now hear for counsel for first fiduciary. If you could just tell us who you are, please.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Thomas Haugrud. I'm appearing on behalf of First Fiduciary Corporation. First Fiduciary is the current personal representative of the estate of William Mackey. It is the third PR, or we sometimes call them the second successor PR. And First Fiduciary is a cross appellant in this matter. First Fiduciary seeks an order of this court reversing the trial court and remanding the matter for an evidentiary hearing on its petition. The petition sought to have the accounts of the initial PR, Ms. Loya, heard and examined, and then to determine the liability between the estate and Ms. Loya, and surcharge her to the extent warranted. Judge Connolly, you asked about the difference between termination and discharge, and you know, Mr. Kemp did a fine job. I'm going to pick up on that. That's a statutory distinction at 524.3608, and it also affects the analysis. So that statute provides that termination does not discharge a PR from liability where transactions or omissions occurring before termination. It simply terminates the authority to represent the estate. The trial court's order is a de facto allowance of Ms. Loyola's account because it can't be examined, and is a de facto discharge of her from liability in direct contradiction to the statutory provision of 3608. There are, you know, alternative basis for this court to reverse and remand, that statute being one. Another that I'd like to address in my time is that when the estate remains open, remains under administration, there is no time limit under Minnesota law to have the accounts of a PR heard and examined. And Judge Riley, I would slightly disagree with Mr. Kemp, and I think this may be an appropriate decision for, you know, a presidential opinion. It does involve atypical facts. There maybe isn't a typical probate, but, you know, this would probably be considered, you know, atypical in the sense that it's been ongoing now for 20 years.
Mr. Harvard, what would the syllabus point be?
During the administration of the estate, the accounts of a PR can be heard and examined at any time.
Until the PR is discharged?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yep. And
so let me ask you, let me ask you though, because there is a difference between accounting and the final statement. Do you think the syllabus point should draw that distinction out?
Yeah, so I was going to get to the closing statement. So the closing statement is separate and distinct. It's a separate statute. It's under 103, and it can only be done after more than 4 months have passed since the publication. The estate has been fully administered. The property has been distributed. A copy of the account has been provided to everybody. And then that statement can be served and filed under the statute. The estate remains open for a year. And only if there are no proceedings against the PR during that year period does the estate terminate. So the closing statement
and
is...
And with that year, in that year period, I assume, so the closing statement is published and served. Does that year give other creditors an opportunity to say, wait a minute, you forgot about me, you know, and then I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do? Is that a fair statement, Mr. Hagerud?
Yes, with a little maybe twist on that. So creditors are generally going to be barred from pursuing claims. You know, claims is a term of art under the probate code since more than 4 years have 4 months have elapsed. But they could try to assert claims within that 1 year period. But it's really with respect to the beneficiaries of the estate. They have then the 1 year period to take some action because when they receive a closing statement, that's the clear signal to the beneficiaries that the PR is trying to close out this estate without going to the judge. And if you don't like it, beneficiaries, you now have 1 year to do something about it. So that's what a closing statement will do. A couple of other points that there is no time bar to hear an account while the estate is pending. I'll also point out that there is, under Minnesota law, no time limit in which an estate can be administered. It may sound sort of strange, but that is in fact the case. And, you know, an estate can go on for 20 years plus, as evidenced by this matter. The statutory provision for hearing an account is at 524.3-1001, And that says a PR can bring a petition at any time to have the accounts heard and the property order distributed. And it says any interested person can also petition as long as you wait 1 year from the appointment. The statute does not provide any outside time limit to bring that petition. Furthermore, determining the liability between the estate and the PR, that's under 3808, that statute says that liability can be determined in a proceeding for an accounting or surcharge or other appropriate proceeding and has no time limit. The trial court relied upon two facts that are immaterial. One is that the account was filed in 2014, and second, that the account was mailed to the beneficiaries at about the time it was filed. The filing of an account in and of itself is of no consequence. It doesn't start the running of any time period. That's not an unusual concept, and here's an analogy. Using the appellate practice, under Rule 10401, an appealable order is appealable 60 days after notice of filing has been served. The filing of the order itself doesn't start any time period, just like the filing of the account does not start any time period. An appeal can be made from an order years after it was filed if nobody serves a notice of filing. Same here. The accounts can be heard years after it was filed if the extra step wasn't taken. The fact that people knew about the order is of no consequence. The appellate rule, you know, clearly states in the case law that, you know, if you were served by the court administrator and you knew about the order, that doesn't start the time running. It only starts to run from the time of the notice of filing. There are other bases for reversing the trial court as set forth in our brief and the brief of appellants Arndt and Thomas Mackey. And I'll have to refer the court to that since my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Berger. I'm representing the respondent in this matter. Appellants want this court to believe that a personal representative who was removed for cause maintains some obligation or duty to have her accounting heard and be discharged. Otherwise, she can be held accountable indefinitely until that probate case is closed. They're trying to shift the blame in this case from those who failed to enforce their rights to the respondent because of her actions. But that defies the policy reasons behind the statutes of limitations. Appellants are arguing, in a sense, that she should have brought this lawsuit or petition. She should have sought that discharge even after she was removed from her position as PR. If she doesn't, then the other people could hold her accountable whenever they like, as long as the estate remains open.
Isn't that precisely what the statute says? This seems odd, but, you know, many things seemed odd to me, and that doesn't mean it's an error of law. It seems to me if your client had wanted to terminate all liability, she herself could have moved to discharge. She didn't. There has been no closing statement. So she loses. Why am I wrong?
Respectfully, Your Honor, you're wrong for a couple of reasons. One, the discharge would have been an option to accelerate that liability determination. And that was an option she could have had. She was advised by counsel not to do that, and she let it sit. As far as a closing statement, she wasn't in a position to do that as the estate remains open. So what she did, pursuant to the court's order back in March of 2014, was she filed that final accounting in April of 2014, but that was essentially, it's more of an interim final accounting. It was her final accounting as personal representative, but the estate remains open. And so what I would compare it to, Your Honor, is if she brings that discharge, essentially she has to She's saying that I am willing to address this and bring these errors to light, but in a normal civil lawsuit or a criminal suit, you don't bring a case against yourself.
Correct. But as a PR, you have special responsibilities. And, I don't know what happened with the estate, but if you're the PR, you're supposed to act in a fiduciary manner to the beneficiaries. And, that's why you're PR. And if you're not going to do that, stuff happens.
And that's absolutely.
And maybe that was a tactical decision, but I'm not so sure it gets her off the hook.
It's absolutely right. She has that obligation as a fiduciary, but she was removed and she no longer had that fiduciary obligation once she's removed. And so in our estimation, in our position, and the April 2014, I'm not saying that's when the statute of limitations started necessarily.
I want to back you up, though. I'm looking at Palm, that case. It says in accounting by a fiduciary, and even if so, you'd have to, as a fiduciary, account up to the point that you're removed. The burden is on her to prove that her actions have conformed to the standard of duty upon her and not upon the beneficiaries. Is the duty satisfactorily to explain? And so her duty doesn't end. She has to explain what she did when she was a fiduciary, or do you disagree with that?
I disagree in the sense that I think there is a route for that, but I don't think that the statutes or public policy supports that that's an indefinite period of time. And in this case, everybody was on notice that in 2014, she was removed for cause. She may have breached those fiduciary duties. And so
if I could interrupt for a minute, it struck me as strange in reading the district court's order that you would look to a general statute of limitations when you're dealing with estate planning matters that has this detailed, adopted from a uniform code, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what's your justification for why a general statute of limitation for contracts and similar actions would even apply here? I mean, what's your authority? Is there any estate case you can point to where the courts have looked to 541.05? I think I've got the right number there.
Your Honor, the authority would be sort of in statute 524.3-1005. The language of that statute of limitations in our reading of that specifically calls out there that a potential breach of fiduciary duty is a separate claim that could be made by people. And where I'm getting at, if you look at that statute, my position is that statute is a shortening of your standard statute of limitations. And there is a case that talks about that, and I'm blanking on it at the moment, but the gist is that statute is in the closing section of the probate code. And that says basically your claims are going to be shortened. Your statute of limitations runs from, instead of 6 years, gets down to 6 months when the closing statement is filed, except for those specifically called out causes of action: fraud, misrepresentation, inadequate disclosure.
And do you think a closing statement has been filed in this case?
No. And so if we read the statute,
it seems to me that's the whole point. That's the time when, okay, this is it. You complain, you got your time limit. But until you get that closing statement, you don't know whether you want to complain or not. And in this case, it seems, based on what your representations were earlier in your argument, that like your client knew there were problems, but didn't want to sort of go there for reasons I totally get, but I don't think that should be held to the detriment of the beneficiary since she's the PR.
But that's exactly why we have statute of limitations, is so that people can bring their claims, and she only has to sit for 6 years and potentially answer for these claims instead of forever. As Mr. Haugrud talked about, this estate's been open.
Under your theory, I could be a PR, okay? I could never move to be discharged. I could loot the estate, never give a closing statement, and just wait 6 years, and I'm home free. I don't think that's what the legislature intended when they established the probate code and have all the regulations and rules dealing with what PRs are supposed to do. I mean, that seems like the exact opposite of what the legislature would want to do. Why is that crazy?
Well, it's not crazy. It's just that's all statute of limitations, right? If nobody takes action, if nobody asserts those rights, if nobody says, "Hey, we were wronged, we were harmed."
But your client took on, she didn't have to become a personal representative. She did. All she had to do was move for discharge and get this resolved sooner. And she didn't. And it sounds like the second successor, you know, had problems with, you know, mental competency eventually. And, you know, I guess there's not a question, so continue on.
Well, and I can respond to your non-question. There was, yes, one avenue would have been to call it to the court's attention and to bring this request to discharge and address the liability. My position is that she didn't do that. Nobody's disputing that. But if somebody wants to challenge what she did, the people and the statutes permit anybody to bring this order or this petition that first fiduciary brought 9 years later, or excuse me, like 7 years later. And so the whole time, the same people, the appellants Mackey and appellant Arndt, as well as that successor personal representative, they all chose not to act on this. Nothing changed factually from the time of 2014 to the time of first fiduciary getting involved. And I don't think that should be respondent's fault now that she has to address these claims.
So do you, turning your attention to 524.3-1005, are Catherine Arndt and Thomas Mackey, are they successors in the meaning of that statute?
Yes.
And weren't they pursuing their rights as successors?
Yes.
And bringing, okay. But you're saying that still isn't applicable because of what?
I'm saying the rights of successors, looking at that statute, the rights of successor and of creditors whose claims have not otherwise been barred against the personal representative for breach of fiduciary duty. That's the main clause that I'm taking away of. They have been barred by the breach of fiduciary duty and the time bar that comes from the general statute of limitations in 541.05. So I'm saying, no, they are successors. They could have done this, but now they're time barred. Now their time has lapsed. And so the filing of this petition is too late. As far as the timing of it, in the April of 2014, the district court, while the order was not all that thorough, there wasn't, I don't think all that much was needed in that there was no alleged breach or any conduct really after 2014. And so those 6 years had clearly passed, and the district court agreed that the general statute of limitations applies to a breach of fiduciary duty. So getting back to Judge Riley's question for everyone, as far as precedential or not, I think it would be helpful in that there is not much case law, or really no case law, that addresses this potentially unique situation. But in a hypothetical situation, this estate still remains open 20 years later. What about 30 years from now? What about 40 years from now? 50 years from now? The end of her conduct is still going to be 2014. Yet 20, 30, 40 years later, she could still be left to deal with and have to address her accounts if we don't put a statute of limitations in place. So I think it would be beneficial to be precedential. I think it would be a simple and easy holding to enforce and to interpret in future cases. Basically, it would be the statute of limitations for a breach of fiduciary duty claim against a personal representative applies in a probate case that remain even though it remains open. It would be that simple of a holding. The general purpose behind statute of limitations also support a ruling in respondent's favor. They're intended to bar stale claims, thereby ensuring the repose of the defendant and the fair and effective administration of justice. Respondent kindly requests that you affirm the decision of the lower court and rule that the statute of limitations for breach of fiduciary duty under 541.05 applies even in an open and ongoing probate case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kemp, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address two points made by respondents and then take any other questions that the court has. First, as the court, several questions have addressed. The question is, does a general catch-all statute like 541.05 trump more specific proceedings in probate? And the answer is no. As the court is well aware, the canons of construction that we will accept the specific proceedings over a general, and this is a catch-all statute. So when counsel for respondent stated that 524.3-1005 barred these claims, you have to look at the language of the statute. It's barred by one of two things: statement to close, everyone agrees hasn't happened, or adjudication. An adjudication is a specific term that has a specific meaning and doesn't include the general running of the statute of limitations. So for that reason, respondent is incorrect. Respondent also states that it's unfair or inequitable that respondent can be held liable indefinitely. But we're not talking about 40, 50 years down the road. There may be lots of reasons, and frankly, I'm in the litigation field. I don't do daily administration of probate, so I can't tell you the tax purposes, but as the court might well imagine, this estate's been open for 20 years, and there might be good reasons, tax reasons, and other reasons to keep a probate open and not distribute all the property from it. A personal representative under 524.3-608 may be terminated, but that doesn't discharge their responsibility. They have the ability under statute to discharge their own liability. Respondent chose not to do so in this case. Those are the points that I have. I would ask if the court has any further questions. Seeing them,
I don't believe we do, Mr. Kemp.
Thank you, Honor. So for the reasons laid out, the court erred below as a matter of law. This court should reverse and remand for an evidentiary hearing on first fiduciary's petition, and appellants will surrender the remainder of their time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is well argued and well briefed. We will be issuing our decision within 90 days. This being our last Zoom hearing, we are adjourned.